pussy sweeter than McCready when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, I'm Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life around North Carolina's Triangle area in earlier times, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll be reading from Wish You Were Here, a collection of essays from the editor of Our State magazine, by Elizabeth Hudson. The Start of Something. When I began working at Our State in 1997, my job was to answer the phone and open the mail in the circulation department. It was my dream to work for the magazine, and although I aspired to be in the editorial department, if I'd been hired to sweep the floors, I'd have been just as happy. Back then, if you called to renew a subscription, you probably talked to me. If you mailed a letter, I probably opened it. And if you put a special stamp on that letter, then you probably made my day. Back then, we didn't have a website. We didn't have email. So the mail was important. Every day I'd go to the post office and collect the day's mail in a big crate. Back at the office, I'd sort through it all and open it. I sat in a small room facing a beige wall, and the task took me about 4 hours to complete. One day, as I was riffling through white envelope after white envelope, I noticed an interesting stamp on a letter. It was a picture of Thornton Wilder, the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright and author of Our Town, posing with his hands folded beneath his chin, a village with a small white church in the background. The stamp cost 32 cents, and it was beautiful, a miniature work of art. I have no idea why that particular stamp struck me. Maybe I was drawn to the way it reminded me of so many small towns in North Carolina. But I cut it away from the envelope and pinned it to my wall. Then I started looking for more. Commemorative stamps are larger than the 1-inch square regular issue stamps. These stamps are special. They're produced in limited quantities and intended to memorialize a person or a place, or honor an achievement or a historic event. Within the year, I covered the wall in front of me with stamps. I got some great ones. There was the Hollywood Legends series, James Dean, Marilyn Monroe, Cary Grant, Alfred Hitchcock. I had the American Music series with Benny Goodman on his clarinet and Glenn Miller on trombone. There was the Four Centuries of American Art series with Grant Wood and Winslow Homer and Edward Hopper's Nighthawks. Once I got an airmail stamp. It was pink, and on it was a picture of a winged flyer and the faces of two men, the Wright brothers. You'd have thought someone had sent me a $100 bill. A Great Lakes Lighthouses series, with lighthouses from Lake Erie and Lake Superior, made me think that Cape Hatteras was surely deserving of its own stamp. Then I found out that the U.S. Post Office thought so, too. That stamp was created in 1972. I wanted to find it. And then I realized this is how collections evolve. The pleasure is in the pursuit. I miss the mail sometimes. I still have all those stamps, stored appropriately in an envelope. I can't bring myself to throw them away. They remind me of where I started at Our State, and they remind me that no matter how much things change, it's important to have something to look forward to, something to set your sights toward. I never did get that Cape Hatteras stamp, but maybe I'll run across it one day at an auction or an antiques festival. I'll keep my eyes open. Because that's the beautiful thing about finding something you connect with, no matter how small it is. It lets you become a collector of memories and a keeper of dreams. Long Way Home. I remember the summer my dad came home with his new truck, a red pickup. We had just moved from town, from a house that was right behind the courthouse in Ashboro, to the country, to a house that was right in front of a dirt road, and my dad believed that a man living in the country should have a truck. He was proud of that truck, and I was too. We took it all over town, my dad and me, riding high in the cab with the windows rolled down, hot breezes blowing across the dashboard. On the nights when my mom worked late at her shop, my dad and I would ride to town to pick up dinner. When I was a kid, Ashboro had plenty of family-style, sit-down restaurants, but I don't remember too many options for a quick takeout meal. There was Ray's, there was Hardee's, and there was McDonald's. From our house, heading back to town, McDonald's was the first fast-food restaurant you came to. We always went through the drive-thru, presumably so that we wouldn't have to get out of the truck at all, kicking off a ritual that my dad and I would enact many times over the years, until I was finally old enough to drive, and I became too much of a teenager to ride with him anymore. At McDonald's, Dad would lean in toward the speakers, and in his deep, clear voice, he'd order the same thing for both of us, every time. 2 double cheeseburgers, 2 small fries, 2 small Cokes. Then we'd take the long way home. I'd stare into the night as Dad drove, a warm McDonald's bag on my lap, the glow of the AM/FM radio on the console. For the next 20 years, my dad drove everywhere in that truck. He hauled me all over town, shuttling me to school in the fall and to my grandmother's house in the summer. He hauled the inventory from my mom's store the year she moved it from downtown to the mall. Years later, when business got so bad my mom had to close her store, my dad loaded up the truck bed, scarred now from years of use, with the old cash registers and the long wooden display tables that once held pounds of cross-stitch fabric and picture frames. He hauled peaches and watermelons from Candor in the back of that truck. He hauled mulch for the yard and Christmas trees for our living room. When I went off to college, he hauled everything I took for my dorm room. In the summertime, he hauled my friends and me. We climbed in the back of the truck bed and went wherever he was going, just for the chance to ride in the open air, watching everything we passed get smaller in the distance. When I got too old to ride with him, he hauled my dog, a short-legged Feist dachshund named Muffin. Muffin loved riding in the truck, even more than I did. If my dad walked to the truck, Muffin ran to stand beside it. She was too short to jump in, and I can remember watching my dad, on those evenings when I had my own places to go, reach down to scoop her up and set her on the seat. She kept him from having to ride alone. A few years ago, my dad sold the truck. It had 350,000 miles on it, and started to have some problems. My dad no longer had as much to haul around, so he relegated the truck to a spot at the end of the property, where it sat for a long time. Evidently, somebody noticed it. One day, my dad was working in the yard when a 16-year-old kid and his dad pulled up. "Your truck for sale?" the kid called out across the yard. He was polite and hopeful. My dad looked at him for a long time and finally told the kid, "I'll take $300 for it." The kid looked at his dad and said, "I'll be right back." They came back in about an hour, cash in hand. They got in the truck, the kid and his dad, and drove off. My dad watched the truck go down the road for as long as he could, until he finally had to turn away. A good year for peaches. Before I came along, and before my parents opened their small business and got busy with the routine of building a life and a home, they were just two people in love. Their first date was at a pizza place in High Point. My mom, who grew up poor and in the country, had never eaten pizza before, and she was so excited. My dad was charmed by her enthusiasm for everything, and after that, he wanted to take her everywhere. They packed picnics and spent Sunday afternoons at High Point Lake. They went to Calabash and ate fried flounder and watched the sunset over the water. They took my dad's Buick Skylark to the Blue Ridge Parkway, the two of them sitting side by side. At night, they got dressed up. I've seen photos of my mom in a plaid sleeveless dress, her hair teased sky high, and my dad in a suit coat, his thick black hair slicked down, and they went to fancier places, like the Zevely House in Winston-Salem, Cellar Anton's in Greensboro, which they knew as Irving Park Delicatessen, and La Chateau in High Point. At the Peddler in High Point, where the servers cut your steaks by candlelight at the table, my dad gave my mom a diamond ring. I could only imagine how happy the two of them must have looked then. Eventually, over the years, they stayed in more than they went out. The demands of running a business and raising a family meant that they stopped going out to eat so much. They didn't take any trips. And then, one day a few years ago, I came home from work and found, on my doorstep, a white cardboard box with a quart of peaches from Johnson's Peach Outlet in Candor. There was an index card sticking up from the box, and in my mom's handwriting it said, July 23rd. Mom and Dad went to Peach Orchard and cruised through Seagrove. Fun Sunday afternoon. On the back of the note, she had written out the recipe for her old-fashioned peach cobbler, something that she made for my dad years ago, a simple dish with ingredients she knew. I smiled immediately, imagining the two of them taking a summer afternoon drive out into the countryside the way they used to. I could picture the two of them together, my mom's excitement over bringing home a new piece of pottery and a basket of peaches and maybe a few ears of sweet corn. I could imagine my dad casually leaning against the car as he watched her, amused and admiring, the same way he did more than 40 years ago. I made a peach cobbler myself that night, and I could taste my parents' day, sweet, simple, and tender, in every bite. Susie Hudson's Peach Cobbler. 1 cup of milk. 1 cup sugar. 1 cup self-rising flour. 1 stick of butter. And 1 quart fresh peach slices. Mix together the milk, sugar, and flour. Melt the butter in the bottom of a baking pan. Add the peaches. Slowly pour the flour mixture on top of the peaches. Bake at 400 degrees for 45 minutes, or until golden brown. The Stars at Night. The fire tower at the top of Dave's Mountain in Asheboro is 100 feet tall, and it was built in 1950. And I wonder how many teenage boys, how many Asheboro high school kids in 1954, say, or 1967, or 1975, drove up here and parked their cars, their Pontiacs, say, or Skylarks or their Chevelles, and climbed the scaffolding, dungarees rolled up, or cigarettes clamped between lips or long hair tucked behind their ears. I wonder how many kids, too nervous to break the rules and scramble up the girders, instead lay on the hoods of their cars, heads back against the windshields, car windows rolled down and music drifting out. Eddie Fisher, say, or Procol Harum, or the Marshall Tucker Band, and stared up at the dark night sky, up here 1,000 feet above the rest of the town, nothing in view but a million tiny glistening stars. My dad climbed this tower when he was in high school in the early 1950s. He was a scout, and to earn one of his merit badges, he had to observe a forest ranger at the top of the tower for a week. Subdivisions hadn't been built on the slopes of the mountain yet, and the road wasn't paved. Every afternoon, he drove his 48 Chevy up the dirt road, parked at the bottom of the tower, and climbed the stairs to get to the trap door at the top. My dad wedged into the tight space next to a ranger, who sat on a small four-legged stool with its legs screwed into glass insulators, and the two of them scanned the landscape below for a hint of anything lit. A match, a flame, some spark or ember. The unobstructed view, high above the treetops, was surely something to see, a panorama of the surrounding Uwaris, a small town made even smaller by the shift in perspective. By early evening, the lights of the town started to pop out, and the sky above faded to blue, then purple, then shades of black, and finally disappeared altogether. They were supposed to keep an eye out, of course, for fire in the trees below, something likely started by a stray bolt of lightning, and I'm sure the ranger kept up his end of the job, But when night fell, my dad couldn't stop looking up. Even now, when he talks of this, I can sense the awe coming back to him, the memory of what it felt like to be up here, so far from the ground, so close to the sky. "All you could think," he says, slowly shaking his head, "is where'd all these stars come from?" As if he was asking how something so invisible could suddenly become so clear. I never climbed the Asheboro Fire Tower, but not too long ago I did climb the tower in Montgomery County. A ranger with the Uwharrie National Forest took me up, and it was a dizzying, nerve-wracking climb in broad daylight. I can't imagine how frightening, or maybe exhilarating, it would be to climb this thing at night. When we got to the top, I saw that someone named Andy had been here also. He had scratched his name, along with a girl's name, into the metal crossbars, and I'm willing to bet Andy and his girl weren't here in the daytime. I'm willing to bet that Andy and his girl snuck in at night, the way people have been doing for generations, and made the climb to the top, two people staring out at nothing and everything at the same time, into the pitch-black darkness, and looking toward the sky, because that's where the light is. Season of Plenty. The tomatoes have finally come in. They're spread out all over the old wooden tables at the Greensboro Farmers' Curb Market, piled up in crates behind the tables, clustered in bags beneath the tables. There are the Better Boys and Big Beefs, the Romas and Cherokee Purples, the Brandywine Pinks and Mr. Stripies. But everybody is looking for the German Johnsons. By 7 a.m. this place is filled with people. There are older men who wear Carolina Farm Credit caps and tan members-only jackets to cover their overalls. They bring their wives, the older women who wear plastic Food Lion bags filled with cucumbers and squash around their wrists. By 10 a.m., the young couples who wear baby slings come. The crowd changes, but everyone leans over those old tomato tables the same way, and it's the same motion every time. Fingertips grip the crown like the machine at a carnival. Insert a quarter, and a metal claw picks the prize. The men and the women and the young couples dig dollar bills out of their pockets, and they move on. There are 82 more tables to get to. Each 10-foot table is filled with something. Tomatoes, of course, but also cucumbers and lettuce and silver queen corn and white potatoes spilling from wooden peck and bushel baskets. Blackberries and scuppernongs and peaches and piles of pole beans and green beans and snap beans and string beans, depending on what you call them. Cantaloupes and watermelons. There are herb plants speared with plastic picks and identified by scrawled Sharpie lettering on yellowing index cards. Basil, $3. And rosemary, $3. And lemon verbena, $4. And butterfly bush, $5. At the end of an aisle, four of those 10-foot tables hold galvanized buckets containing lisianthus and irises and Shasta daisies and red geraniums. The flower vendor has been here since 1973. Her mother is 86, and she's here, too, tying stalks of dried hydrangeas. The mother sits in a tall chair and has her feet planted on a red slatted footstool. She touches the forearm of everyone who stops to talk, and she offers advice to a customer who's buying a tall cut flower arrangement for a centerpiece. "Are you sitting down at the table to eat?" she asks. "Then let's cut these shorter." She reaches for a pair of pink Fiskars cutters and lets the severed stems fall to the floor. That floor is remarkably clean, and everyone in this building keeps his space neat and tidy. Behind most of the tables are large igloo coolers that transported the tomatoes and the corn and the cantaloupes, the pies and breads, the cheeses and the bacon and the eggs, and the flowers this morning from farms in Gibsonville and McLeansville and Reedsville and Madison. Beneath one table, two quarts of blackberries sit, squirreled away for later. On another table, a vendor keeps money in a worn Tampa Nugget cigar box. She covers the box in a pink towel and smooths a plastic bag over the top of it. a homemade security system. Nobody bothers it. She opens and closes the box 40 times in an hour, trading change for all those tomatoes, the better boys, the big beefs, the Brandywine Pinks, and the one everyone wants, the German Johnsons, that she hauled to market today. She works hard, and by the end of the day, you hope that her table is empty. You hope that her box is full. This is summertime in North Carolina, our season of abundance, when the days are the longest, the earth yields its full capacity, and tables all across the state are filled with everything anyone could ever want. A Handmade Christmas. In 1982, my mother started tying bows to sell in her crafts shop. Back then, there weren't any big-box arts and crafts shops, no Michaels or Hobby Lobbies. There wasn't even a Walmart. People came into her store every day, asking for bows to put on their mailboxes and fences. They hung bows on grapevine wreaths and bedposts. They ran bows up staircase banisters. Bows were an inexpensive decoration for a lot of households in rural North Carolina. Even men came into the store to buy bows for the fronts of their cars. To keep up with this demand, my mother tied bows every night. This is what I remember. After she closed her shop for the evening and came home, she kept working. She ate a warmed-up dinner plate of food, and then she gathered an armload of red velvet ribbon in 25-yard spools, stacking the spools next to her chair in the den. Most nights, I sat on the floor next to her and did my homework, and I remember hearing the soft whoosh as she tugged on a spool, uncurling 5 yards of ribbon at a time. She tied bows until about 11 p.m. every night, piling up a hill of them on the floor to take to work the next day. My dad made bow boards out of 4-by-8-foot sheets of pegboard and propped them against the walls in the shop. My mom sold her bows as fast as she could make them, as fast as she could pin them to that bow board. She sold about 100 bows a day, but at Christmas time she sold a lot more. 500 bows, 700 bows, all in one day. It's hard to imagine. She kept this up for another 8 years, until she closed her shop 22 years ago. I remembered all of this when we decided to put a bow on the cover of our annual Christmas issue, and it seemed fitting that I asked my mother if she'd be willing to tie a bow we could photograph. I bought a roll of red velvet, took it to my parents' house, and watched my mother go to work. I watched her go through the familiar steps, unfurl, cut, gather, twist, and pull the loops. She tied a few to get the right one, and after a few minutes of watching, I stopped seeing the bow at all. I started to notice her hands. My mother's hands have seen a lot of work. They've tied a lot of bows, but before that, they strung tobacco and they picked peas. They scrubbed floors, and they turned beet red in hot dishwater. And they held paintbrushes and hammers, and they dyed hair, and pinched dough for pie crust, and they occasionally pressed against a little girl's forehead, checking for fever. When I was very little, she wore a diamond ring, her engagement ring, on her left hand. It slipped off many years ago when she was washing dishes. Her ring went spiraling down the drain before she could fish it out of the soapy water, and she cried out for my dad to help. He took apart all the plumbing, but they never could retrieve her ring. My mother cried and cried. Over the course of a lifetime, she has wrung her hands in sorrow, and she's clapped them together in great joy. And on the evening I was at my parents' house, watching my mom tie this bow, I remembered many more moments of clapping, many moments of joy. She finished the bow and handed it over to me. "I hope this will work," she said. "I think it does." Outdoor Dreaming. In the summertime, when I was a child growing up in Asheboro, I spent nearly every daytime hour in one of two outdoor places, either swaying from a hammock suspended between two heavy oaks in my grandmother's backyard, or pushing off from a white wooden swing that hung from the painted blue ceiling of her front porch. She lived in a tidy white 1940s-era bungalow with a thick lattice of roses trailing up the east side, and patches of clover mounding the front lawn. The blue porch ceiling, she explained to me, was to keep insects like wasps and yellow jackets from building nests up there. They see it as an extension of the sky, she said. I learned a lot of outdoors folklore from her, that you can split the bark from a sweet gum and use it to brush your teeth, or that a fig tree should be planted next to the side of a shed to shelter it from winter frost. But truth be told, I was more of a bookworm than any sort of nature enthusiast. One of the reasons I loved staying with my grandmother in the summer was that her house was across the street from the Randolph County Public Library, and at least twice a week we walked over to stock up on books. I carted them to the porch, where I sat for hours in that swing, or to the hammock in the backyard, where I stretched out for so long the tightly wound rope tamped deep indentations into the backs of my legs. These were the days in which I discovered Judy Blume and S. E. Hinton and Lucy Maud Montgomery, devouring the stories of Margaret and Iggy and Deanie and Ponyboy. I read while my grandmother worked around the yard, weeding her garden or just resting on the concrete bench that anchored a row of her prized flowers, heavy-headed peonies, and gentle hydrangeas. For her, there was no better place to be than outside, and after my grandfather died, I think she was especially grateful to have someone else out there to enjoy it with her. Another body outside who kept the swing from sitting still. Somebody else to help swat away flies and smell the sweet shrub growing wild. What is it about being outdoors in North Carolina that creates such a powerful draw? Maybe the answer is in that hammock. On those days, my grandmother brought a book of her own out to the backyard, and the two of us laid side by side on that taut weave of rope, content to immerse ourselves in our own worlds and spend a small eternity drifting and staring up into the clouds, having been granted permission to do nothing and the freedom to do everything. Those days are long gone, but often, whenever I think of Anne of Green Gables or Ramona Quimby and all her exploits, I'm transported to the time of my childhood and connected to my grandmother. I see her in the outdoor spaces, and when I think of her, I still look up toward the clouds, an extension of the sky. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening.
Be finer than to be in Carolina in the morning.